It's 8:06 on this Wednesday morning, April 22nd. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Currently 38 degrees and rain here in Old Town Park City. Heber City reporting 44 degrees. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Earth Day, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. As we go throughout your Wednesday, look for scattered showers and rumbles of thunder to develop, particularly across the Heber Valley as we go into the midday and afternoon hours. Temperatures will climb into the mid-50s for highs. In the Park City area, we're looking at scattered showers and rumbles out there potentially as we go throughout the day with those temperatures hovering in the upper 40s for highs. Now, as we go into this evening and tonight, those temperatures will drop. And we're looking at temperatures dropping below freezing as we get into the Heber Valley and in the Park City. So, yes, overnight tonight into tomorrow morning, we'll have that chance of seeing some snow showers moving through the area. And we could have some light accumulations. Not expecting a big deal out of this, but could be a couple of inches, particularly up towards Park City and up above in elevation. Meanwhile, the Heber Valley could pick up a dusting to an inch out there. Overall, those temperatures dipping down into the upper 20s, but will rebound back into the mid-40s in Park City for your Thursday afternoon. We'll see those highs rebounding into the mid-50s in the Heber Valley. Once we move into your Friday, look for a mixture of sun and clouds. There will be a chance of a few isolated showers out there. Temperatures in the low 50s for highs in Park City will be in the upper 50s to near 60 in the Heber Valley. Your weekend forecast is looking unsettled once again. The first half looks to be the best half of the weekend. Saturday features partly cloudy skies, just a slight chance of an isolated shower by late in the day on Saturday. Highs in the upper 50s in Park City will have those high temperatures into the low 60s in the Heber Valley. Once we move into your Sunday, we'll be looking at a chance of scattered showers in the Heber Valley with temperatures back into the mid-50s. We'll see a chance of scattered rain showers, maybe changing over to snow showers, especially by Sunday night into Monday morning in the Park City area as temperatures dip back below freezing once again. Temperatures start off on the cool side heading into next week with more chances of light precipitation across the area. Overall, a cooler and more unsettled weather pattern settling in as we head towards the end of this week, heading into the upcoming weekend. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back on ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Stay tuned. Coming up this morning on the Local News Hour, I'll be checking in with Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation Executive Director Mike Lures, along with Summit County Epidemiologist Nancy Porter. Later on, President of Deer Valley Resort Todd Bennett in with a recap of this ski season, and from the Wasatch Community Foundation, Board Chair Cy Hutt with an update on the foundation's work. Then stay tuned for The Mountain Life. Today's guests include Caitlin V. She shares the science and straight talk behind her new book, Harder, Better, Longer, Stronger. Then therapist Keith Kurlander, along with Dr. Will Van Der Veer, will unpack the promise and limits of psychedelic therapy in their book, Psychedelic Therapy, A Revolutionary Approach to Restoring Your Mental Health and Reclaiming Your Life. All of that coming up on today's edition of The Mountain Life, heard, of course, every Wednesday from 9 to 10. Well, taking a look at some local news now, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers were in Wasatch County yesterday morning. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports few details are known about the targeted operation.
Heber City Police Chief Parker Sever confirmed reports that federal immigration officers were present in Wasatch County and taking people into custody Tuesday morning.
I called up ICE to check into it. And they were not doing random, you know, like an enforcement raid. They were targeting specific individuals they were looking for that were wanted.
Sever said Heber police were not notified ahead of time that ICE would be in the city, and the department was not involved. He did not know how many people were arrested or how many agents were in the community. Videos and photos posted on social media show what appeared to be agents in the Heber shopping center at the intersection of Main Street and 600 South. Agents wearing vests labeled ICE were also photographed near Smith's and the Wasatch Commons townhomes along US 40. Sever said he had also heard of possible immigration agents in Midway, but had not confirmed the information. Wasatch County Sheriff Jared Rigby told KPCW via text that his department was not notified of the ICE operation and did not participate. He said no one had been brought or booked into the jail. ICE's Salt Lake City Field Office did not immediately respond to an email from KPCW Tuesday. This is a developing story that will be updated as new information becomes available at kpcw.org. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, the garage under construction at Canyons Village will have paid parking next winter. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports that there are also a few ways to park for free.
Visitors at Park City Mountain enjoyed the first two floors of the Canyons Village parking garage for free this past winter. When the full five-story structure opens for the 2026-27 season, parking will be $29 per vehicle before noon and free after that. It's not yet clear if reservations will be required. According to an internal Park City Mountain email obtained by KPCW, there will be limited space for free carpool parking, meaning vehicles with four or more people. Surface parking on the rest of the old cabriolet lot where the parking garage is under construction will be free, and employees will still get free parking in designated areas. In an email to employees, Sharon Otteson, Park City Mountain's Vice President of Base Operations, announced there will be a Canyons Village winter season parking pass option too. No details about pricing or pass availability were included. Mountain spokesperson John Canaley says more information is coming later this summer. Historically, Canyon's upper lots have had paid parking. The base area developer intends to consolidate parking in the new garage to pave the way for developing the upper lots. According to Otteson, the Canyons Village parking policy is based on, quote, successful parking changes at Mountain Village. Data from Park City Municipal showed car traffic around Mountain Village eased during the 22-23 winter. Staff at the time attributed that to the resort's paid parking and reservation system. While Park City Mountain waits on the city to process an application to upgrade Mountain Village side chairlifts, changes are ramping up around the canyon's base. Skiers bade farewell to the iconic cabriolet in March. It's being replaced with an enclosed 10-person gondola called the Canyons Village Skyway. The Skyway will follow the same route from the new parking garage to the Red Pine Gondola area with a mid-station near Silverado Lodge. A new gondola also replaced the Sunrise Lift last December. Vail Resort's Epic Promise Foundation is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
In the studio now with an update from Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District, I have Director Mike Lures. Also joining us from Summit County Health Department is Epidemiologist Nancy Porter. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Mike, maybe just start first with a little bit of background. We've got a new wastewater metagenomic study happening. Tell us about that.
Yeah, maybe a best way to start this is to kind of go back and review what we've currently been doing for the last couple of years. So twice a week, we collect samples from both of our wastewater treatment facilities and send them to the Utah Public Health Laboratory, which is part of the Department of Health here in the state of Utah. And we look for the genetic material associated with COVID and measles. And that's called wastewater-based epidemiology. Well, for the last couple of months, we've been holding some discussions, and we formed a partnership between the Summit County Health Department, the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District, and the Public Health Laboratory in Salt Lake. And we have initiated what we call a wastewater metagenomics study. In a nutshell, what that is this is where the wastewater samples are sent to the laboratory, and all of the genetic material, the RNA, the bits and pieces of the RNA and DNA are sequenced. And the goal is to look for pathogens, antimicrobial resistant bacteria, and other potentially harmful microbes. And this gives the health department a real heads up on the health of our community. And it's the first of its kind in the state. We're kind of doing a 6-month, test study here. And we've got the results back from a couple months, and we've done all the quality control and all, and it's looking real good. So, with me today is a representative from the health department. I'll let her introduce herself here. Nancy Porter, she's an epidemiologist with the Summit County Health Department.
Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning. Yes, this is a great project that we've started, and it's really cool stuff that we're doing. Everyone's kind of been familiar with the COVID testing that we've done. When COVID first started, everyone was getting tested in laboratories, and we had so much information on who had COVID. We had great numbers, but then we had at-home testing, and we didn't really know how many people had COVID. So then we turned to the wastewater, and it gave us such a great idea of what was going on in the community, and it's been so helpful. And so it's also been really helpful for measles. And it's like, well, what else can we do? And so that's kind of where this is kind of launched. I know this has been many of conversations before this got started of what else could we look at and how else could we use this? And in our community, you know, we get information on Summit County residents. I do a surveillance data. So if you're sick and you go and it's a reportable disease, I get that information if you're a resident. But I mean, most of the times here, we have a lot of people here that aren't residents. So wastewater really helps us understand what's going on in the community, gives us some heads up so that we can talk with the hospital, see what they're seeing, let people know, hey, we're seeing this circulating, these are the symptoms, watch out for it. Or, you know, flu nationally was a really big flu season this year, but we just didn't see that here in Summit County. Maybe it was a little bit of a low snow year, so we didn't have as many people coming in, or it could also be, I mean, numerous factors, but now we have more at-home testing for flu, and wastewater will really help us understand, you know, what does flu season look like here? Encourage people to get their flu shots. Typically we see flu start a little bit later than you do on the East Coast or some other spots. So we normally kind of shift our recommendations of when to get your flu shot based on those types of numbers. And wastewater will help us have a better idea of what we're seeing and when we're seeing it and be able to make that flu shot last longer and make people informed so that they can make decisions best for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, flu and COVID, they tend to be winter, you know, sicknesses. So what are you going to be testing for in this next 6 months?
So there are a lot of summer things, too. We have, you know, a lot of kind of those more outdoor diseases with some of the enterics and the campylobacter. And there's different things that we can check to see what's going on. And we've seen a slower rollout for RSV too. And so that's something that normally is in the winter, but we've been seeing an extended season. It kind of shifted a little bit. But COVID's also every now and then makes a summer occurrence. And so I think by looking at wastewater, we'll have a better idea of maybe some more of the seasonality of diseases, but also just see what's in the community. When people feel sick, not everyone goes to the doctor to get tested, so we're not really sure what's going on all the time. And I think there's so many different things that we're looking at in the wastewater, and Michael will go over a whole list, but there's so many things that we can look at, and we're really trying to hone in on what's useful, what can we actually get accurate results for, and things like that. But it really helps us understand, you know, what's going around in the community.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, is it like a blood test? I mean, right, but you take, you know, some blood, but you have to put it, in different pots so that you can measure glucose, or you can measure cholesterol, or you can measure liver enzymes or something, right? So is that how this wastewater works?
Metagenomics is a little different, and there's two advancements that now make metagenomics possible. And metagenomics just means that we're looking at all the genetic material in a sample. So the first thing that has changed is the genome of most pathogens have now been sequenced, and collectively, all of those genomes have been placed in a worldwide genome repository so that if you run a sample and you want to know genetically, is this associated with, say, polio, you can go to that repository and it matches. So that's the first thing. The second thing is the laboratory advancements now allow for the sequencing of all RNA and DNA in a sample at an affordable cost. And for us, in the health department, to look at a wastewater sample and look at hundreds of pathogens, it's about $250, which is exceedingly inexpensive because it gives the health department a real great idea if something is starting to pop up in the community and they can help, you know, do something about it. I have to give a shout out to the Utah Health Laboratory. There's a PhD guy down there who's a wizard at sequencing, and he's brilliant. Really good to work with, but let me give you an analogy. An analogy of metagenomics is to think of a very large box, say the size of your house, filled with jigsaw puzzle pieces. However, each piece in the box is from a different puzzle. Now, the task is to assign that each piece of the puzzle to a specific, you know, specific puzzle. So you go to a repository and you compare each piece to a repository that has millions and millions and millions of pieces, and you come up with a unique sequence so you can make a match. So when you take a sample, you ask, how is it done? All the genetic material, including all the bits and pieces and detritus and all the junk in there, you sequence all the RNA and DNA, and then using very high powerful computers and advanced algorithms and software, you go back to this repository and you look at billions of pieces of DNA, and you try to make a match. And that's now something that is affordable and thus enables Summit County Health Department to protect the public's health by sequencing everything that's in wastewater.
Yeah, so much for our decoder rings. You mentioned that this is the first study of its kind in the state of Utah. I mean, so why was Summit County chosen? I mean, there's a lot bigger places to get more material.
The truth of the matter is Summit County Health Department has been extremely proactive in protecting the public's health. And we got together and we talked to the public health laboratory, talked to the head guy down there, and we said, hey, is this possible at an affordable cost? He said, let me look into it. And he came back, he says, yeah. He said, that's affordable. We can do about $250 a sample. He says, let's run some tests, you know, like quality control and all that. Came back really good, and so we're now taking samples. So it was just something that we've jointly came up with, and the state laboratory has agreed to take it on.
Yeah. So what is the cost of, you said $250 a test, but who's paying and
well,
how many are we doing?
The health department is paying for it right now. We'll probably split it with them. Right now we're taking, I believe, one sample a month?
Yeah, we're just doing one sample a month. And yeah. I think the plan is to kind of test this out and kind of split the cost. And, you know, this information helps us, helps, you know, with wastewater testing as well. And I mean, honestly, we're just a bunch of nerds that really, really like this stuff. And it's, you know, and we're in a unique situation where we have the opportunity to do this. And there are other groups that do wastewater testing. You know, there's Wastewater Scan Online that has spots across the U.S. and they test for a bunch of different things. But to have this one local with so many different things that we're looking at is really unique and a great opportunity that we have here.
You know, Leslie, for us here at the wastewater utility, you know, our men and women who work for the district are exposed to the raw wastewater every day. And through this testing, if something, say, unusual pops up, something like Zika or even polio or something, we would like to be able to inform our employees, hey, guys, yeah, we always have the nasty stuff, but something really strange is, or different is now in the wastewater, take extra precautions. So from the wastewater point of view, in addition to obviously collaborating with the health department, is to protect our employees.
All right. So again, in 6 months, we'll know what?
Well, we're starting to get results every month. And the list of pathogens that you would expect to find show up. As far as I know, nothing really unexpected has shown up, which is great. Mm-hmm. But that's part of the purpose of all this is, hey, if something does pop up that's unusual, that really is, you know, out of the ordinary and needs the health department's attention, we'll know about it.
Okay. Moving on, Mike, what is the latest with the wastewater testing that's already been done every week? And again, this is also considered, you know, the COVID and measles testing also considered metagenomic?
Yes, metagenomics kind of think of the whole thing, whereas the COVID and the measles just a tiny little piece of it. So ironically enough, on the East Canyon Wastewater Treatment Plant, which is think of the western side of Snyderville Basin and all that, COVID's up. It bumped up, and ironically enough, I had a couple friends in this last month come down with COVID. So I was anticipating this elevated level of COVID material, and sure enough, it showed up. As far as I know, everything on measles, everything's still negative in Summit County, on at least the Snyderville Basin area.
Yes, everything's still negative on the measles side. I don't think we've had a positive sample since March 31st. And in Utah, we're at 607 cases, but for the first time in quite a while, the state's only reported, I think, 4 cases in the last week. So hopefully that's a good sign that this is decreasing. And we're seeing it in the wastewater statewide as well.
Okay. Also, Mike, you track what we call the flush index. You basically count the number of people based on what you see in terms of flow.
Right. So for the month of March, our visitor night count was 299,163. That's greater than an 8-9% decrease the previous year. No surprise that with the poor snow conditions, people were not here, and that's reflected in our numbers. Along with that, I would like to mention that there's a free household hazardous waste collection day this coming Saturday. It'll be at the Silver King parking lot up there by Park City Mountain Village from 9 to 1. If you have unused pharmaceuticals, you've got paints, oils, all those kind of things, batteries, it's all free. Help protect the local streams and bring in all your hazardous materials to the free household hazardous waste collection day.
Okay, and you love this, and I know you're a big sponsor of this, just because you don't want to see it.
We don't want it in the wastewater, mm-hmm. because if it gets in the wastewater, it gets in our local streams. And a shout out to the Sunrise Rotary Club. We're the volunteer workforce behind it.
Okay. The tip of the month is
right.
Bring your drugs. Can you bring your drugs to the household?
This is a kind of a big item. Hey, if you have leftover pharmaceuticals of any kind, drop them off, no questions asked, free of charge at the household hazardous waste day, because if you flush those drugs down the commode or the sink, we do not remove those compounds from the wastewater, and those drugs end up in East Canyon Creek. So this is a big deal. So don't never flush unused pharmaceuticals. And here's a great opportunity to get rid of them at no cost.
Okay, this Saturday from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. there at the base of Park City Mountain in the Silver King parking lot.
Yes.
You know, also, Mike, I wanted to bring up, as you know, we've been reporting on the cleanup efforts at the former site of Treasure Mountain Middle School. Mm-hmm. And there's been a problem with contaminated water being dumped into the stream right there. This isn't your problem, as you know. I mean, you deal with the water that goes down our toilets and sinks, but you do certainly have the job of treating water, and the water that's being treated at the former school site is now not just letting the heavy metals like arsenic and lead and mercury sink into a tank. They're actually now using chemicals to add to these tanks. Can you tell us briefly how this works?
Again, I can't talk about the specifics of their permitting or what they're doing, but the typical treatment process to remove heavy metals from water is to add a chemical such as ferric chloride or something like that, and it forms a flock. It clumps it up, and then that settles to the bottom, and the clean water comes off the top. That is standard heavy metal removal, and it's my understanding that's the overall general process that they're using. And that's a proven long-term type of treatment for heavy metal removal.
Interesting. Okay. And so I was thinking it dissolved it, but it clumps it, and then that settles to the bottom.
Right. That settles the bottom. They collect it, and then they haul that off and dispose of it accordingly. Usually it's done in like a couple tanks in a row, and I just driving by out there, I know they got multiple tanks in a row. And that's standard procedure.
Okay, and again, the settlement stuff needs to be go out to Twilla or something
right.
like that.
Right, it depends on the concentration as to what they can do with it.
Interesting. Okay, hey, Nancy, Mike, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What normally be the week after ski season closed, we're already 3 weeks out from when the lifts stopped turning here in town. In the studio now to recap what could be a historic season for a few reasons, I have the president of Deer Valley Resort, Todd Bennett. Thank you for coming, Todd.
Good morning, Leslie. Great to be here.
Todd Bennett. I started to say Burnett, but it's Todd Bennett. Again, on any normal year, you would have been holding your staff party this week, anxious for the snow to melt so that you get the amphitheater open for summit concerts. Instead, you've probably already been on spring vacation and back again, huh?
That's exactly right. Yeah, we were out last week with the kids.
Yeah, so we all kind of feel gypped that it didn't snow much this year. How challenging of a year was it for Deer Valley?
Yeah, you know, it was unique in the sense that we were so excited to have, you know, 7 new chairlifts, 100 new ski runs, all of that hard work we've been doing over the last couple of years to get the mountain ready. It was definitely a little anticlimactic, But I am so proud of what the team was able to pull off. We made more snow than we've ever made. We were in the neighborhood of, gosh, probably 500 million gallons of snowmaking this year. So we were able to put out a product that when the temperatures were cold. As we know, it was kind of fluctuating right around freezing a lot of the winter. But we made great snow. We had 185 ski runs open this year. That was a record for us by, gosh, probably 70 more runs than the previous year. And I'll just tell one quick story. We were just around Christmas time, and we were so excited to get the new gondola open and pinion, and we were just having tough temperatures. We had extra snow at the base of the pinion lift, and the grooming and the cat team decided we're gonna take one bucket load at a time, literally front end loader on the cat, and build a run to the top of pinion just to get that open for the holiday guests. And so there's a number of stories around the resort on what people did to make the absolute best experience we could for the guest. And, you know, that's something that we hang our hat on and had a lot of pride in.
Yeah. And just as you've mentioned, I mean, there are a huge amount of resources put into getting snow down on runs that we never even saw opened at East Village. So what was the thinking there that it was going to snow and with a bit of a base, you know, you would be able to get something open?
Yeah, you know, there was, I think we had 185 of the 205 or so runs open. So yeah, there was 20 runs that weren't. There was a couple of runs that had snowmaking on them that we just didn't have the temperatures to finally make it. We kind of focused our resources on making sure we could have the great top to bottom skiing from the top of Park Peak down to the bottom of the gondola, Lady of the Lake, which is just an amazing, great intermediate run kind of down right off our new six pack bubble. But yeah, you know, I think we're in a really good spot for next year. You know, I will say most seasons, at the end of the season, it's like, you know, it's time for a break. And certainly you always feel that. It's a long winter. But this was the first winter that I've been at Deer Valley where I said, you know, I take a couple of weeks off and I'd run it right back. Because, you know, you want to see all of those runs, some of those great steep north-facing runs like Hellcat off Redemption Ridge. You want to get into that terrain and explore more. So I'm pretty excited for next ski season, even though we're 6+ months away.
Yeah. So I'm guessing that what you invested in with the snowmaking there on the east side of the village, you've got like top of the line technology. Does that need to get replaced on the other side, the old Deer Valley, to make sure that you've got, a way to open in more variable winters?
Yeah, the equipment that we put in on the east expansion, we put in Techno Alpine fan guns, which are just incredible. They can just push a ton of snow. So those are the big kind of green circular guns that you see over there. And then we put in a lot of HKD stick guns, which are low energy. Kind of, they don't produce as much snow, but you can run a lot more of them just because they use a lot less air. So there's, we're kind of always upgrading the fleet, but we have on the top of a Bald, we use a lot of snowmaking guns called Ratnik. It's out of Western New York, Ratnik Industries, and they are fantastic at making snow in wind. So what I've learned about the snowmaking process and the team has taught me a ton is there's kind of a tool for every job. And there's a lot of different kind of tools in the tool set that they have. So, there's no need to change out necessarily the snow guns that we have or the hydrants that we have on the existing or classic Deer Valley, and as we expand to the east, we just use the latest and greatest, but very capable system all around. And what was great, our lead snowmaker, Bear, he was able to work very closely with the mountain design team so that when they were building pumps and air and all of these different new systems, that they were able to kind of seamlessly work back and forth across both sides of the mountain. We do have three, maybe even four unique systems where we have a lower mountain on the Park City side, an upper mountain system on the Park City side, and then the East Village is kind of its own system, so they can all be isolated and run. I'm going to get this number wrong, but I think at the peak coldest day, we had over 300 snow guns running at one time. So it was pretty incredible. I think 18,000, 19,000 gallons a minute, and we're going to get over 20,000 gallons a minute next year.
Wow. And again, 500 million gallons of water, that's, you got to pay for it, yeah?
You do?
Plus to pump it.
Yeah, you got to pump it.
And then plus to the electricity to blow it.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Sure.
So I'm guessing that your utility bills were enormous.
It was higher than the previous year, for sure.
Okay. Well, then, how did visitation compare to expectations? And what I've heard from Ski Utah, they're expecting a 20% drop in skier visits for the year. Is that kind of what you saw as well?
Yeah, you know, probably not as much as 20%. We were expecting to go up year over year because of the expansion. So we were down a little bit year over year for sure, lower than expected. But that's just part of the business that was kind of expected when we saw the weather patterns that we did.
Okay, well, what's still to come in East Village? I know we got a ton of construction at the base.
A lot of construction at the base, a number of great hotels. We're going to have a new base lodge down at right below the gondola. And then we're in construction on Park Peak Lodge, which is, you probably saw the outline at the top of the gondola this year. That is going to be just a spectacular site for food and beverage and for weddings in the summer. And I think that's going to be a really exciting piece.
So the base lodge will be done for next winter, and then I think Park Peak the following winter?
Both are actually the following winter, so we're about 18 months out on both of those.
Okay.
So next year, you know, a few more, we're looking at adding a few more snowmaking runs on the expansion side, so we're looking at adding maybe one more lift, because why not? That's what we do. We just add lifts. But I think there's an opportunity to look at a new install over on that side as well. But I did want to talk a little bit about summer.
Okay, I know we've got somebody coming in for summer. So
we do. Okay.
Yeah, let's talk just the current status of the Snow Park base area and
sure.
parking lot redevelopment there. We've heard that that's not going to go forward this year.
That's right.
How come?
Yeah, well, so we are still working on the plan. I mean, obviously, it's a massive project. We work closely with the city to get the right-of-way vacation that I think a lot of our listeners know about. But as we kind of looked at the volume of work that we're doing right now at Deer Valley, a key component of that is making sure that we get that expansion just as you'd want it on the existing Deer Valley side. And so we're really spending the time, the resources, and planning and making sure that we're getting all of the pieces, all those new runs, a lot of, you know, there's a few guns on Redemption Ridge that as after we skied it, we're like, you know, it's probably in the wrong spot. We want to move that gun 20 feet further to the east. And so we're making a lot of tweaks that maybe the average guest wouldn't see, but we're spending a lot of our energy and time making sure that we're getting all of those runs dialed exactly as we want it. So I would say as much as anything, it's organizational focus.
Oh, okay. I mean, I'm just saying, is funding a consideration as well? Because you've spent certainly more on getting East Village open this year than you maybe have expected in that.
No, it's not an issue of funding as it relates to the project on the east side. I mean, they're pretty separate projects, and it's not an economic piece.
One thing at a time. Okay, are you pretty sure that this time next year, though, you'll be underway with Snow Park? Or?
You know, we've got a couple more planning hurdles to go through. We have to submit a CUP2, which we have the CUP1 that was approved by the Planning Commission. That was the horizontal, that's the parking structure, that's the roadways and that infrastructure. The next up is getting CUP2 approved. So we're working on that plan now. That's the vertical construction. That's what will sit on top of basically the giant parking structure that we're going to build down there.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about that, because at one point Deer Valley was looking at some sort of tax increment financing for the Snow Park redevelopment. How does this get paid? I mean, do you go out and bond? I mean, it's a private company.
Yes, yeah, we're a private company. There are a few things that the team is working on in terms of how that would work. A lot of it is actually looking for partnerships, so limited partners in terms of investors that would be a part of that. But Deer Valley very much would still control the look, the feel, and be a participant in that. But a lot of that funding is more on the would be on the limited partner side. The team is also looking at some different kind of standard tools of development, whether they be bonds those types of things. But I probably want to bring in my side and partner Hannah Tyler to help us on that one.
Okay, is MIDA in any of these discussions? Because it seems like that's kind of the go-to, you know, to get projects done.
No, not on the Snow Park side.
Okay, and the hotel that Deer Valley is planning to build at Snow Park, is the thinking that this would be an international brand, or do we have them all used up on the East Village side of things?
We have been in talks with a number of hotel companies. We have a couple that we think would be really good and high quality, internationally recognized brands. There are some really great hotel brands out there to continue to partner with.
Okay. And we know that Utah Symphony, Utah Opera has scaled back its concert season, thinking that construction might happen. But you're going to kind of fill it in with the stateroom concerts?
Yeah, working with the stateroom, working with the Utah Symphony. I think, you know, part of that is as much is that I think they're on the road this year. I think that's really more the reason why they've got fewer concerts at Deer Valley is they're doing a great statewide tour, Stephen and the team there, and pretty exciting. I think they're going to be down in Bryce Canyon at some point, so we're going to try to go down there and see them on the road.
Great. Any news on the possible gondola from Quinn's Junction area?
No. I've heard some of the discussions on that, but nothing new that I'm aware of.
Yeah. And what about there were some plans, I believe, for your Bonanza Drive property? Is that going to get developed with some housing?
Yeah. Looking at that as well, that is a condition of the snow park project, which is we do have to bring employee housing in town, and so we're also concurrently working on plans what that could be and looking at the funding mechanisms for that as well. But no, nothing formal or approved or ready to break ground.
Okay, and then with the summer season, like I said, we're going to bring somebody in later this spring, but opening date is kind of set for when?
Opening date, yeah, so we're going to do something unique this year. On June 13th, that is going to be that first weekend. We're going to kind of do a preview weekend, and that's going to be for Deer Valley season pass holders, and that's also going to be for folks who have the mountain biking pass. So, you know, one of the things that many guests we've got to get the word out better at is that if you buy a season pass for next year, you get all of the summer, whether it be for scenic or for mountain biking. So it's a good opportunity for guests to buy early, a little bit of an incentive. And then this year is for the first time, we're going to do a preview weekend just for those season pass holders on June 13th. And then I believe it's the 19th Friday, that's when we open for all guests. And that will be daily through Labor Day, and then we'll go weekends for a bit after that.
Okay. And that's usually about when you open, yeah?
Yeah, maybe even a little bit early.
Okay.
I think we might be 1 week earlier. You know, when we made the decision a couple of weeks ago, that's where we're going to target. The weather was looking really good, not like the light snow flurries that we're having now in our mountain town. But, yeah, I think we'll be in great shape. Obviously, a lot of that has to do with the snow melt and the runoff, and we saw mountain bikers up on the mountain yesterday.
Oh, wow. Okay. Where is that snow line? Mid-mountain and above, or...?
It's actually pretty high now, and we still have snow on Big Stick and a couple of those runs, but that's just because we made so much snow in there.
Okay. Todd, anything else you want to mention?
I guess one other thing on summer that we'll continue with Kids Ride Free. So that's a great scenic program. So if you have a paying adult, you're welcome to bring kids and get up on top of the mountain and enjoy the cooler weather and go out for a hike.
Okay. Todd, appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Good to see you, Leslie.
That's Todd Bennett, president of Deer Valley Resort. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. In the studio now with an update from the Wasatch Community Foundation is president of the Intermountain Health Heber Valley Hospital. He also serves as chair of the Community Foundation. Cy Hutt, good morning. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Leslie.
Cy, why don't you start by telling us what the Community Foundation is and what it is that you do?
Absolutely. We've been around for almost three decades now, and we got our start in education, but we've really branched out to five different pillars. So education is still one of those focal areas, but we also look at recreation, the arts, health and human services. And we named those pillars because if you have the visual of pillars holding up a structure, that structure is a healthy and vibrant community. So we really focus in all those areas. We have some projects that we just do, but we also collaborate with a lot of others in those spaces.
Yeah. 30 years, you said, huh?
Yeah, 26 years we've been around.
Okay. So what are the biggest needs that you're seeing right now in the Heber Valley?
There's a lot of different ones, but we're trying to focus on in each one of those pillars and have multiple things going on. We have some exciting things kind of heading out the spring with our health pillar with school-age kids that have been really fun.
Okay. Well, let's walk through the health pillar then. What is it that you're working on?
Well, we have a Healthy School Awards that we do, and there's a criteria there that the Wasatch Community Foundation established with those schools. And there's a variety of things, school wellness, safety health, healthy school lunches, healthy education, physical activity, staff wellness, all those things give you points as you meet those criteria. And then we have three of our schools that will be receiving the Gold Award. That's the Heber Valley Elementary School, the Midway Elementary School, and the Daniel Canyon Elementary School. And then the Old Mill Elementary School met that at the silver level. So we'll be honoring them. We'll be giving them a check to use towards healthy pieces, and just a fun way to engage on health.
All right, more than a certificate, cash in hand.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
Yeah, and you're also working on a Safe Kids Fair?
Yes, a Safe Kids Fair and a mile-by-mile marathon. And this will be culminating on May 4th in the evening from 4:30 to 7:30 at Southfield Park. And elementary school students have been challenged to go 25 miles or do 25 miles worth of exercise, basically. And if they've reached that, then they come do the last 1.2 miles with the Wasatch High School student athletes. And so that's they get a marathon medal and a T-shirt, and it's really kind of a fun event. And we have a lot of community partners there. The hospital will be there giving out free bike helmets and doing helmet fittings. And we'll also have a teddy bear clinic where we'll give kids a teddy bear that they can take to the doctor to help them feel a little more comfortable with what happens when they have to go to a doctor.
Okay. And also with the arts pillar, I know that we did report on this a little bit last night, but we've got the Tom Tabby Memorial happening also in May.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful story. There's a great part of our heritage and history there. And Tom Tabby, the son of Chief Tabby, died at just 12 years old in a hunting accident. And he's buried there in the cemetery in Heber. And there's a marker and a little memorial there that talks about his story. But it was pretty weathered, really hard to read. It had really gotten worn down. So one of our board members, our treasurer, Marvin Rust, who's on the arts pillar, worked with the cemetery and with the city. And we're going to be putting a new memorial there. And May 2nd at 1 o'clock, we'll have the kind of the open house, inviting people in to learn about that and see that. Also a great partner with Delta Stone, helping to make that happen too.
So. Okay. And then looking at kind of the human services pillar, where are you working on projects with that?
Yeah. Food insecurity is a major issue, and one that we're actively engaged in all the way from students to our senior population. We have projects on that. We work really closely with the food banks. So that's an area where we just do that ongoing all the time and need funding to support that. We're also starting to work a little bit more on the affordable housing side of things, again, in that collaboration role. So we're working with the Wasatch County Housing Authority and the Heber Valley Chamber of Commerce to bring together developers and local officials just to educate a little bit more on what are some of the federal and state resources that are available to help build affordable housing.
Yeah. Okay. So with your work with the food bank then, is that just purely financial, or do you actually have volunteers that help with that?
Yeah, we do both. We do food drives every couple of months as well as help to supplement.
Okay. And then this upcoming housing, a workforce housing meeting, it's not public, but where will there be some kind of reporting on it? I mean, what happens after that meeting?
Yeah, that's great. Hopefully, as we educate there, it'll just build a little bit more momentum with developers on how to have that happen. So hopefully that will result in more attainable housing here over time. So yeah, okay. We'd love to report back on how that meeting went.
All right. And then another pillar is with the self-reliance. Tell me about this.
Yeah, self-reliance is kind of under the human services, but really is, true to its name, pretty self-reliant. And they were very involved in the recent emergency preparedness fair, helped with the organization of that. That was in March. Had a great turnout, good education there. And now we're kind of focusing on the Harvest Festival this fall. We've got quite a bit of ground there on about 1236 East and Center Street, and we will be planting that field with potatoes on May 23rd, and love for anybody who would like to come out and join us with that. And then in October, we have the couple days of the Harvest Festival where we'll be harvesting those potatoes, but have a variety of other things going on as well. Again, a lot of education, but if you are willing to work in that potato patch and help, you can get some of those potatoes.
So. Nice. So why potatoes? Just pretty easy to grow.
Pretty sustaining. So.
Okay. And then finally, with your recreation pillar, what are you working on there?
Yeah, the recreation pillar, we're very excited to help participate with the pump track that is going in there in Southfield Park. So on May 29th, we'll have an open house on that, and that'll be open, and it'll be a great thing. So that's, I think, an example of how we collaborate with other organizations to bring needed things to the community.
All right. So. And what do you have, board members then that kind of chair each of these pillars?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So Tori Broughton is our recreation pillar chair. Diane Glenn is over human services with Russ Olson on the self-reliance side. Jonelle Fitzgerald leads the health pillar. Carrie Zibaldo leads that arts pillar. And then Kathy Carr leads the education pillar and also is the vice chair of the committee. So it's kind of decentralized there, and those pillars do great work, and our job at the board is how do we support them?
Yeah, I was going to say, how does the foundation identify which projects or organizations to support?
Really, the pillars do that. Mm-hmm. We just try to coordinate efforts there, build awareness, engage with community partners to assist them, and help with the fundraising.
Yeah, and how is the foundation funded?
There's a few grants, but it's mostly the donations of community members. We'll be rolling out a program. Corey Noyes joined our board recently, and he's going to be heading up the Wasatch Club, which we'll be kind of announcing this summer for sustainable supporters of the foundation. Celeste Johnson is also a new member of the Wasatch Community Foundation, so excited to have her, and she's helping us with the awareness and promotions.
Yeah, what is your annual budget?
We have about $400,000 of need that we fund each year.
Wow. Okay. Now the Heber Valley, of course, growing rapidly. How does that affect the work you do?
It does. I mean, all of these areas, it strains them and brings more people to the community, but that also brings more people to the community who want to pitch in. Been so impressed by a lot of the new members of our community who want to figure out how do I get involved, and the Wasatch Community Foundation is a wonderful place to do that because we have such a broad reach.
Okay, and then looking ahead, what are the foundation's top priorities over the next year or two?
Yeah, we actually just went through a kind of a strategic planning process where each one of the pillars looked at and developed those areas, so we'll be able to garner our focuses a little bit better. Sadly, Leslie, I did not bring that with me. So off the top of my head, I probably will mess it up for our pillars.
Okay. Anything else, Si, that you wanted to mention?
We just really a request, I guess, for people to get involved. There are a lot of growing needs, as you mentioned, the attainable housing, food, people who don't have access to health care. All of those things are getting more and more challenging. We need people involved who can jump in to put hands on the ground with that as well as to help to fund it. So please reach out to us. The best way to reach us is on our website, which is our, and Wasatch Community Foundation is WCF. So ourwcf.org. And that tells a little bit more about each one of the pillars. It gives you contact information about how to reach out to those pillar chairs. And then there's a place on there where you can donate as well.
Okay. Si, I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Leslie.
Si Hutt is the chair of the Wasatch Community Foundation. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, Utah has ordered Colville to put debt from an independent tax district down on its own balance sheet. KPCW's Connor Thomas explains why local governments around the state are worried.
State lawmakers, local officials, attorneys, and accountants met April 16th to discuss the future of public infrastructure districts, or PIDs. PIDs are frequently used by developers to get cheap financing for things like roads, water, and wastewater infrastructure. They do that by issuing bonds that only taxpayers within PID boundaries pay back. PIDs usually share the same boundaries as the development they're attached to. The Utah legislature designed PIDs so that the local governments, which create them, don't have any liability. But last August, the unfinished golf resort in western Colville, Wahali, which has a PID, declared bankruptcy. Utah State Auditor Tina Cannon took notice. Her office has now directed Colville to include the PID's outstanding debt in its 2024 and 2025 financial documents. Justin Lee is the deputy director of the Utah League of Cities and Towns. Colville's situation has other governments concerned they'll have to do the same.
There's all kinds of concerns about, you know, whether or not we would be liable for something they did or if they entered into bankruptcy.
Mayor Rory Swenson said at an April 13th city council meeting that Colville disagrees with the auditor. But the auditor's office can impose its will on local governments by withholding money, such as sales tax revenue, if they don't file correct financial reports.
Colville's important because it's the first time we've seen this interpretation.
Lee says he wouldn't be surprised to see new legislation clarifying the relationship between governments and their PIDs. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, the 56th anniversary of Earth Day is today, and Recycle Utah marking the occasion with its annual dinner. A few tickets remain for the Earth Day celebration at Twisted Fern. Recycle Utah Executive Director Andy Heck says the $100 tickets include appetizers, beverages, and a look ahead at what's next for the organization.
We've been doing this for many years, and we are looking forward to this one very much so because we have some pretty big announcements about the land and new facility and all sorts of really cool things going on right now.
Heck says that a public benefit analysis published last week shows that the land donation from Park City Municipal, now a clear community benefit, a required step before the property can finally be transferred.